Welcome to Writers Talking TV, brought to you by the Writers Guild of Canada. I'm Nicole Demers, and I'm a screenwriter who has written and produced on shows including Mohawk Girls, Forget About It, and Degrassi: The Next Generation. Today's guest is Emily Andress, showrunner of Winona Earp. Winona is the great-great-granddaughter of the infamous lawman Wyatt Earp, and the series is based on the graphic novel written by Beau Smith. When Winona returns to her hometown of Purgatory for the funeral of her uncle, she not only inherits Wyatt's mythical gun, but his mythical abilities as well. Winona is determined to end the family curse by putting down every last supernatural villain Wyatt ever faced. It's been called one of the most straight-up entertaining shows on TV right now, so I hope you enjoy the conversation. So I figured we'd start just talking a little bit about how you came to television.
Okay.
And just to kind of set the scene for people.
Sure.
Because it is such a crazy business, and there's no, you know, unlike being a lawyer or a doctor, there's no set rules on how you, you know, go to medical school and then you intern and you get a job. So how did you sort of find your way to television, and did you always want to write television? Is this sort of like from a kid, you know, I want to do that.
Right. I went to medical school. No, I didn't. I always loved television. I'm not going to lie. I come from a household where my mother was a librarian, so she loved to read, but she also made no bones about the fact that she would watch every episode of Days of Our Lives. So, like, any type of storytelling in my house was very embraced with open arms. And if you could tell a good joke around the dinner table, you were celebrated for sure. But I would be lying if I said that I didn't think writing was something that was done by smart people. Like, I really did, right? Like, writing for TV seemed like something people in Hollywood did. I grew up in Calgary, Alberta, so I couldn't have been farther from the television industry.
So Winona's kind of homecoming for you.
So Winona's kind of a homecoming, yep. Anyway, I did a degree in English at Queen's University, and then I was doing the dance of, like, should I go to law school? Should I do this? And my mom said, there's this radio and television course at Ryerson that's 2 years. It's a postgraduate degree. And I was like, well, that's a great way to kill 2 years. I applied, I got in. And as part of that course, there was a writing segment. And you had to write a spec script, which is a speculative script for a series that is already on television. And I had to find adjudicators in the business to mark the script. So that basically meant I had to find some sucker who was a professional writer to actually read this poor student's script and note it. I'm dating myself a little bit here, but I got a hold of the WGC handbook.
How did you find people's emails?
I got the WGC handbook, and it was when they published writers' emails, which they don't do anymore because of me. You're welcome. And I emailed basically everybody who had an email. And I have to say, for the most part, because I was desperate, because of course it was like the night before it was due.
And like if you didn't get someone to market,
I was just going to be like, this is a genius work, but up and coming prodigy.
By Stan Smith.
Yeah, exactly. By Steven Spielberg. But I have to say that was a good example of I found writers in general were incredibly gracious about a lot. Tons of people wrote me back and said, okay, sucker, I'll read your dumb script. Because I feel like every writer you've met remembers what it's like starting out and being like, I have no idea how to do this. How do I get anyone to read me? I really don't know what I'm doing. So honestly, the friend script was like 70 pages long. It was like written in like PowerPoint. There was way too much Ross. But... And I know there's like one person who's like, how can there possibly be too much Ross?
Ross.
And lots of people had different responses to it. But one writer in particular named John May, who you may know, who works with Suzanne Bolch, they're very well known. They've created many a kid's show, said, okay, kid, you're really funny. You don't know anything about structure. But if you kind of come under my wing and work with me on your scripts, I'll give you a script on this new CBC half-hour show I have called Our Hero. And that's what I did. I just wrote and wrote and wrote and cried because I got terrible notes and learned the whole process. But then I got to write an actual script for a CBC show.
That never happens.
But I also want to say after that, it wasn't like I just leapt onto Game of Thrones. Still waiting for that call. But I also did a lot of work in production. So I worked every single award show. I was a driver. I got Ron McLean and Don Cherry coffee at Hockey Night in Canada. Like, I really did all those
kind
of things.
Paid your dues.
Yeah, I paid my dues. I worked at a game show at YTV. So I kind of worked the production half of television as well while I was waiting. And then finally, Epitome Pictures. I had some friends at Epitome Pictures, which is famous for this little show called Degrassi. They were launching a show called Instant Star, which was basically a fictionalized take of American Idol. And they needed someone young and gullible and cheap to redo the Bible. So I did, and they liked my work, and I got hired as a coordinator on that show. And then by the third year, I was show running that show.
Full disclosure, Emily and I actually worked on Instant Star together.
We did.
But we haven't seen each other in a while.
Yeah, exactly. Since 2 years ago.
No, exactly. And sometimes that's actually a good way for young writers to break in, mm-hmm. is companies are a little bit notorious for looking for, you know, somebody who will do it on the cheap, right?
Yes, because
an experienced writer will charge too much. And so, you know, sometimes it's not always the nicest way, but sometimes it's a good in, you know?
Yeah, and I would say, like, Epitome in particular with a show like Degrassi, they really have done well by young writers, but at the same time, they may not be the most lucrative. Hopefully no one here from Epitome is here. This isn't being recorded or anything, right?
But I mean, we both had great experiences.
We did. And my point I would say about that is because it was kind of a story factory, you really do kind of get tossed in with the snakes and learned how to do story. You just don't have a choice. They're very disciplined. They just have to churn so much out that I learned so much about how to break an episode and write. And it was terrifying in all the best ways.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. It's funny, like, whenever I go to cocktail parties, you know, you'll meet people, and it's not in the business, just in regular everyday life, and they'll, you know, they'll say, hi, I'm a writer, and you're, you know, you're kind of, oh, that's interesting, what do you write for? And they're like, you know, I write my journal and blogs, and as a writer myself, I'm really reticent to introduce myself as a writer, so I say, what do you do? I'm like, I work in TV, you know?
When I fix TVs.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I work on a show, you know? It's such a weighty title, writer, producer. What was the moment in your career, like, what gig, when you kind of sat back in the room and looked around and said, holy fuck, I think I might be a writer producer.
That's such a good question.
I think I've arrived.
Oh my God, that's such a good question.
Are you still haven't had that moment?
No, I still have the fear. Like, I still feel like I still have the 3 a.m. where I'm like, what am I doing? This is a weird response to that question. I feel like the first time I knew I could make this as a living was the first time I got to say no to a job. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's real power at the beginning. You really have to take everything that comes your way, and you should. You should not be egotistical about it. So the first time I was like, I think I can do this, but I don't think this project is perfect for me, but I know that another project will come along, that was like freedom to me. I was like, oh my God, I can decide what type of writing I'm going to do. That sort of felt for me like, I think I can do this. And my agent said, yeah, you can say no to this. And I that sounds crazy, but that's when I think you know you have choice. When you have choice, I felt like I could do it.
Yeah, the power of no. I mean, that's when you can kind of shape your career and like say, I only want to do this. You know, I want to focus on hours. I want to, that's a lot of freedom for sure.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
When you're not taking every like digital series that comes and every animated script that comes by.
Right.
Yeah. No, I hear you. That's actually an excellent answer.
Oh, thank you.
So just to talk a little bit about Winona Earp, when we were having our pre-interview, you were saying it's such an unusual show for Canada to do. I mean, it's based on Wyatt Earp's great-great-granddaughter.
Famous Canadian Wyatt Earp.
Yeah, exactly. American
Canada's
icon.
Canada's greatest gunslinger.
Right. And although, you know, obviously being from Alberta, we do have a Western tradition, but still Westerns are very much known to be American. And so how did you, as a Canadian showrunner, sort of get involved in this?
Right.
Yeah.
So I've worked on a lot of different television. I started out on Instant Star. I've done Degrassi. I did a lot of animation, which I know you do. And then I often say this to young writers. It's really about finding a few people who will take a shot on you. Like, that's what you need. You need one person to take a shot on you, a producer, a director, a writer. So my person was a lovely writer who's very well known named Michelle Lavretta, who show ran Instant Star. She has created Lost Girl, which was a show I went on, and she has now created Killjoys. Anyway, she really brought me onto Lost Girl, despite the fact that I had no hour-long credits. She really went to bat. I think she lied to every network and was like, she's great, which is a total lie, and sort of adopted me and put me on Lost Girl. So as soon as I landed on the show Lost Girl, which was about a bisexual succubus who sucks energy when she has sex, as you do, I really kind of fell in love with genre. I just saw that you could do so much storytelling, even on a shoestring budget, that was kind of big thoughts and big themes, and you could kind of do huge switches in tone. So I knew I wanted to stay in genre if I had my druthers. So there's a company called IDW, which is sort of like the fourth largest comic book company in North America, maybe. I'm sure there's people here who are going to correct me, but it's kind of like DC, Marvel, Dark Horse, and then IDW. they had this cult comic called Wynonna Earp. And if you look at the original comic, it's really like she's very top heavy. She's kind of wearing like band-aids over her boobs and like fighting Egyptian mummies. And she's got like huge blonde hair.
As they do.
As you do. I don't know what you wear fighting Egyptian mummies. That's your own business. But
standard issue uniforms. Exactly.
So, but they were quite interested in this project because it had a certain wit about it. And the character was kind of this badass. It was in development forever. It was at Fox. To no one's surprise, Jessica Simpson was attached for like 2 seconds.
No
and
way.
If you know Wynonna now, you're like, what?
You could have worked with Jessica
Yeah,
Simpson.
I know, exactly. So by the time they sort of gave it to me, they knew they wanted a female showrunner who had genre experience to develop it. And honestly, despite the band-aids over the boobs and the Egyptian mummies, or maybe because of, when I opened the comic, I honestly got kind of a tingle up my spine. And I was like, this really feels like there's something incredible here. There's this amazing female protagonist. You could kind of do a gender swap on the idea of the famous hero, like Wyatt Earp. She's a very reluctant hero. She's a huge fuck up. And of course, it was a supernatural Western, which I felt like growing up in Alberta, I was very keen to maybe find a property that we could set over there. But also, I feel like it was a genre that had kind of needed a new resurgence. That being said, I did a really aggressive pitch, which sometimes you do. Like, I was like, there's nothing in this comic we can use. So I basically pitched it as Buffy meets Frozen. Good luck figuring that one out. But I really wanted to take kind of like, this sounds obnoxious, like the patriarchal tradition of the Western and just have a bunch of women running around. So I wanted to make it about sisters, and I wanted Wynonna to kind of inherit the mantle of being this hero, even though she is in no way heroic. She's a complete mess. And have an older sister who was kind of groomed to be this hero who had died. So Wynonna was like, I'm actually not supposed to do this. I cannot do this, but no one else can do it but me. So I did that pitch, and everybody was like, that's crazy. If you can do it, sure, we'd love to see it.
Great.
So
yeah.
That's kind of what happened. But I still feel like we really fooled the network and kind of got this crazy feminist supernatural Western on the air. And then the way I kind of pitched the Canadian angle is like, I really feel like it has a Canadian sensibility. Like, it's very feminist. There's a lot of LGBT representation. It's very diverse. There's a lot of themes about being the underdog and whatnot. And we are still a 10 out of 10 Canadian production, which means, like, everybody on the show is Canadian, and we shoot in with an all-Canadian crew and whatnot. So there you go.
I'm going to pull that one out. Hold on.
Okay, no problem.
I had a question about that. Yeah, so it's a perfect segue.
No problem.
So for those of you out there who don't know, there's kind of two major funds. So the Canadian Media Fund is the public fund, and then the IPFs, the independent production funds, are really run by broadcasters. And there's been a recent decision that came down on the IPFs to allow 6 out of 10s, mm-hmm. which means that your screenwriter and your lead actors no longer have to be Canadian. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, shows like Orphan Black with Tatiana mm-hmm. Maslany, there's been a lot of press about that, you know, that show might not look that way had this decision come down.
Definitely wouldn't.
Right. I mean, you know, they would have hired Graham Manson.
Jessica Simpson.
Right.
Yeah.
No, seriously. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, would Graham Manson be showrunning?
He would be great. Yeah.
And would Tatiana be in that lead?
Mm-hmm.
And she's, you know, won an Emmy for it. Mm-hmm. So if Wynonna Earp was in development today and you were doing first season, do you think it would look the way it looked?
I don't know if it would look the way we looked, and like, I'm not sure I would be on it, to be honest. And I think it would be something very different with Jessica Simpson. I think it would have a very different sensibility, and like, there's room for that too. But that decision is tough. You know, I just think like the narrative, without getting too far into it, is that the narrative that the CRTC is delivering is like that we can't compete on an international scale. And like, I absolutely think that's not the truth if we look at what's happening with Canadian television right now. Like, we make so much less TV, but I feel like our batting average for how good that television is so much higher. Like, I don't know how many pilots in the States just debuted. I'm going to say 1,000. Is that about right?
I think there was 400 and something shows that are actually going to air, whether they'll last or not. There's a lot.
Yeah, exactly. So I feel like we don't have that luxury in Canada. We can't kind of like make a billion shows, debut them, and then cancel them after 3 episodes. So I just think we do have a very skilled group of writers and actors in particular, who is really who it's going to affect more than anyone, to be honest, and directors and whatnot. I think Canadian TV more than ever is embraced and adored around the world. I just think we have to stop pretending it's the 80s and like we can't compete. We absolutely can, but we need to support it. So,
and ironically, I think, you know, genres competing the best out of anything, right? And historically, Canada's kind of done character dramas and character comedies because they're cheaper, right? Yep. All you need is a bunch of actors. You write a drama or a comedy and that's it. And genre tends to be so expensive, you know, as special effects budgets. And I know that money is always an issue in that world. And yet somehow that's what's actually competing really, really well on the international market. Why do you think that is?
Well, you're going to see an episode of Winona tonight, and you're going to see the special effects, and we're going to talk about that later. But because I think it forces the storytelling to be that much better. Do you know what I mean? I think it forces us to have a viewpoint and a sense of humor and a tone that maybe you don't find on television elsewhere. I think
because you can't rely on the special effects.
Exactly. So, like, ultimately, Winona is still about character. You know, it's still about the sisters. It's still about these relationships. It's still what it is to be human and be a woman and all that and what makes a hero, all that stuff. And I really think with genre in particular, like going all the way back to Buffy or Star Trek, like people care less if you can see the zipper up the back of the werewolf costume, if they feel something, if they love the characters and they cry when Buffy sacrifices herself to save her sister or whatnot, you've done your job. And because genre, even though it seems silly, can really deal with themes of humanity and what it is to be human, you can kind of explore those big Shakespearean storylines, and the audience is already there for it. Like, they're there with a big spoon. They want to eat it up. I find genre fans are very open-minded and quite sophisticated, for lack of a better term. I really think they are. They're pretty smart, so they can handle pretty fast-paced story and lots of changes and lots of mythology. So, we've just mastered that. But again, we just have very strong female-driven genre in particular. If you think of like Orphan Black and Continuum and Bitten and Lost Girl, that kind of seems to have been our niche, and I think there's a real audience for that in the world.
I'm going to mix up my questions again because
there's
another.
I'm going to grab my tea.
It's another perfect segue because you know, there's two women on the panel right now, so
yes,
we have to talk about this
because
it's so in the public consciousness now. You know, and there's been many times in my life when I've walked into a story room and you know I'm the token chick, right? Like you just walk in, you open the door, and you're I'm that person. And, you know, it would be so lovely to think, oh, I got hired because of my intelligence and my script and, you know, my humor.
I bet you did, though.
Oh, well, that's
very
sweet. But you know, you just know that you're there to fill a role. Any minority kind of feels that way if they're, like, the different person in the room and they're there to fill a niche and as opposed to just being a member of the team. And, you know, I actually had the pleasure of working on Mohawk Girls this year, which was the first time in my career it was all women.
That's amazing.
Was two women showrunners and three writers in the room and then even a woman coordinator. So it was kind of all, but you know, having said that, the caveat to that is it's Mohawk Girls. It's not like big, strong guys, you know, fighting crime, you know. I'd love to see that room be all women.
Yeah, sure.
But what challenges have you had? Because obviously you're a female showrunner, you know, you've done a couple shows now. Have you had to fight against any of those stereotypes? Do you see it changing over the 10 years that, you know, you've been doing this?
Oh my God, I could do like an hour on this, but I won't. Yes, of course I've had a million challenges, like a million challenges. Like so many horrible producer stories. Buy me a drink, I'll tell you them all. Like, you know, the first one I remember is just like some guys I worked for at the producer where like every single time I went to the photocopier, I was like the coordinator. He would say to me, he would come over the second I got up and say to me, oh, if I wasn't married, and I was like, is that the thing that's stopping us? The fact that you're married, that's just stopping us from going to the
that's
Motel
such a
6
great
right
line.
Now? I'm like, thank God for your restraint, sir. I mean, I've had a million challenges. You know, the one famous one I had, when I was a showrunner, I had a male actor who was really difficult, and it was like 3 a.m. I'm just telling tales. Everyone take notes. No, it was like 3 a.m., and he hadn't learned his lines, and he was notorious for doing that. And I kind of did the big, like, honestly, Hoosier speech where I was like, you got to rally. This is it, dude. It's all on you. You got to learn your lines. We're all waiting on you. We all want to go home. And he said, I'm just going to say what we're all thinking. Your tits look amazing in that sweater. But, you know, I was a showrunner then, and I remember, honestly, in that moment being like, the only person who looks like a jerk here is you. Like,
you
I'm still the boss.
Yeah, I was saying,
learn your lines. I have to say, like, one thing I feel like I had the advantage of was being kind of stupid when I was younger. It never occurred to me I couldn't do this because I have a vagina, which is amazing, you know? I feel more now that I'm older and a showrunner, I feel more aware of the discrepancy and being responsible to young, diverse writers of all kinds to kind of give them a leg up. I'm more aware now that I'm in a position of power that if I have a choice, I need to spread the love a little bit. So, I've had lots of challenges, and one thing I still think as a female showrunner is I do still consciously make the choice about when to lose my mind or not. You know, I worked with a lot of showrunners who have a terrible temper or can't control themselves or are screaming at people, and they often get away with having an artistic temperament, a Trump-like temperament, if you will, screaming at someone if you're wrong. I'm very aware that I feel like I have less punch cards in my crazy, if you know what I mean. Like, if I break a chair over someone's head, I feel like, okay, you get two more this year.
And it's a perfect allegory, yeah. Right? I mean, Clinton could never get away with what Trump is doing. No. So it's across the board.
Exactly. But I also feel like, again, like, I'm older and I apologize less for that stuff. You know, I know what I don't know. Like, now I'm the boss, so I don't care if I don't know how we're going to light this scene. That's not my job. You know what I mean? It has nothing to do with whether I'm a woman or a man. I know my strengths and my weaknesses. It's all about working with people. So yes, there's been a million challenges. There's still a lot of challenges. I really want to encourage people. I think Canada is so far ahead of the curve versus the States. I think, like, you just look at who won an Emmy this year. I mean, all the awareness of this change is happening at a blistering pace. Social media, too, is, like, making it so that people can't get away so much with, like, having an all-male writing room or not hiring any female directors. People are watching this stuff now. People are invested in it. So change is happening before our eyes, and it is getting so much better, even since when I started. So, like,
and television's so ahead of the curve of film, you know? I mean,
yeah.
Only 35% of the writers in the Writers Guild of Canada are women, but
right.
You look at what feature film is, and,
yeah.
You know, I actually don't know the stats on writers, but I know the stats on directors is,
yeah.
Like 3%.
Directors really is really hard. Directors,
yeah.
Is the area we're not bringing people up fast enough, women fast enough, for sure, and diverse people as well. Like, we're just not getting it there. So, but we will. Like, at least we're talking about it. Like, it used to be we just never talked about it.
Well, that's
so.
The thing. And even like you said on the Emmys this year, it was really interesting. The pendulum swinging the other way, because
mm-hmm.
if there was a woman in the category or a minority in the category, it seemed like there was a conscious effort to choose that person. You know,
and I hope so.
Yeah.
Because of their work too, I think. Yeah.
Well,
sure.
Well, that's exactly,
yeah.
It. I mean, as much as you kind of notice it, you think, well, they're all there for the same reason. You
exactly.
Know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it is, and you just hope that just doesn't become a fad that fades out. You know what I mean? And then people stop talking about it and they go right back to the status quo.
I don't think they will. I think the world is changing. I just think people, audiences are too smart. Like, I just think you can't get away with not being able to write good women and good men, and it doesn't matter what you look like. I always have at least parity in my writing room, so I always have at least equality. And certainly with directors, if given a choice, I will still hire the woman, because we're just not there yet. So
okay, well, someone much smarter than me said, you know, that running a show is like running a corporation.
Mm-hmm.
And what I really find interesting about this is, not to stereotype writers, but generally speaking, we
mm-hmm.
tend to be more interior personalities.
Mm-hmm,
you know, you have to be good with sitting in a room by yourself for 8 to 10 hours a day with just your imagination and a computer,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yep.
And so that's a very specific personality
mm-hmm.
type. And then, you know, if you're lucky enough to sell a show,
yeah.
And get your show, and you know, someone says, okay, you can be a showrunner. Suddenly you take that person who is really, really interior and solitary and a bit more of a loner personality, likes being on their own,
mm-hmm.
likes doing their own thing, and you're thrusting them into the limelight.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they've got 100 people underneath them
mm-hmm.
that are looking to them for leadership and vision.
Mm-hmm.
You're in meetings 24/7,
mm-hmm.
you know, 16-hour days.
Oh,
you
yeah.
can't get a break.
16-hour days. What is it, a Sunday?
Yeah.
Just kidding. No.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
And forget about being on your own with a computer, you
yeah.
know. So I just wanted you to talk a little bit about, because people ask me what's the toughest thing writing for television, and I think it's that.
Yeah.
I think it's navigating the fact that you have to be two personalities at the same
yeah.
time. And I live, like, my husband's very much
Nicole's husband.
that personality of, like, gregarious sales guy out
right.
there all the time.
Right.
So it's really hard to be two people at once, and
right.
how have you navigated that?
It's hard. Like, I always equate it to, like, if you're the person on the assembly line who builds the boxes, and then you become the manager of all the people who are building boxes, like, those could not be two different types of jobs, right? Just because you're good at building a box doesn't mean you're good about being like, hey, good box building.
And you need to show the vision of the box.
You do, exactly.
Sell the box,
and like, some people need tough love to get their box building done. Some people need like a pat on the back. The truth about me, which is awful, is like, writing is still the least favorite part of my job. Like, I hate sitting in front of my computer by myself. So I feel like, oh, like, no matter how long I do it, I'm like an outline. This is the worst. I really like people, so I feel lucky that way. But that definitely was the biggest leap, I think, being a showrunner, is it is management. And it's a business with a lot of ego, right? It's a business with a lot of big personalities, from actors to producers to artists to writers to what you have you to directors. Like, these are people with vision who aren't afraid to use their voice for the most part. And like I said, you have to manage people differently. Everybody is looking for you to decisions. The biggest thing I want to say to showrunners is, like, you just have to keep the trains going. You have to make decisions. Blue sweater, red sweater, whatever. We're casting this person. And the other thing I think that was important for me to learn is that everybody just wants to be heard. You know, like, everybody's pretty keen. I think 90% of people I work with want to do a really good job, and you've hired them to do the job they're good at. So it costs you nothing to share the praise, and also trust your people to do the good job. Like, I'm happy to let the props guy build me something amazing, and I'm happy to say, I trust you, do this, here's my guidance, but, like, you're going to knock it out of the park. So it's like anything. People just want to be heard.
Well, you actually get, I was watching a couple interviews, and you get really high marks for that, right?
Oh,
like, a lot of your actors were saying, you know, she listens to our suggestions. She asks us for ideas. And, you know, the biggest thing was listen to them.
Right.
And that's pretty rare. Like, most showrunners, you know, dirty little secret would be like, I don't want to go ask my actors what they think this next thing should be. You know?
Right.
So what sort of, why?
Yeah, why? Oh, because
or how does
actors.
It help you?
Yeah. No, I mean, it's all within reason, right? Like, I think, and it depends on the person. Like, I, you know, that actor who said, hey, nice tits in that sweater, maybe gets less chance to improv than someone I really trust who, like, is always prepared, who's like, can I try this because I'm also going to do it your way? I'm more willing to say, yes, you have earned that right to improv or what have you. I just think it costs you nothing to ask your people if they have any good ideas. And, like, here's the truth. Like, I'm the showrunner. I created Wynonna Earp. If you do something amazing, I'm still going to look awesome. Like, you know what I mean? That's the truth. It's like, there's lots of praise to go around. In the same way, like, if this sucks, I'm going down. So it's in my interest to let you have input and feel like you have ownership of the show, because you're just going to try your best, you know? You know, the one place I feel like maybe that is less true is the writing room. Like, I take all the ideas in the writing room, but that's the place I'm most confident about being, like, more like this, less like this, more like this, more less like this. The other big lesson about showrunning I feel like I had to learn is, because it's so exhausting, because it's 16-hour days, 18-hour days, 20-hour days, is just as a people pleaser, I had to learn that, like, someone was always going to go home unhappy at the end of the day. Like, you are the boss, and you just aren't going to get to everything. There's always going to be an email you didn't answer, or a decision you didn't make, or you didn't go to a meeting because you were at another meeting, or you didn't get that draft done, or you didn't do casting. And you're just doing triage all the time, right? You're literally like, what is most on fire? Like, what is going to affect what we are shooting tomorrow? And that's something you have to live with for months at a time, right? There's always homework. When I'm playing with my kids, I'm like, oh my God, there's like 20 other things I really, really should be doing. So more than anything, you have to learn to handle that stress, I think, or you'll die.
Fair.
Peace out.
On that note,
yeah. On that note.
Why don't we watch the episode?
Sure.
And then, because all the other questions kind of pertain to the show in particular.
So can I just say one thing about this episode? I struggled about what episode to pick. This is episode 2 in our first season. So I deliberately picked this episode because it's flawed. It's not perfect. Episode 2 is really hard because you write the pilot for like 2 years and then you sit down and you're like, oh my God, does this series have legs? What the hell is this series, right? There's special effects I hate in it. There's a middle part that's a little bit bumpy, but there's moments of joy and fun and the acting is great. So I just wanted you to see that, like, this was worked on for 15 drafts. It's not perfect, but sometimes this is what you get. So,
and also,
don't leave. It's not that bad, but...
And also,
I
probably
deliberately picked this one.
The most realistic of the episodes, right?
Because
you have 2 years to do pilot, and then you have, like, you know,
2 minutes to do episode two, and you're like, ah,
2 minutes to do episode 3, and okay,
yeah.
Great.
So
let's watch
thanks,
that.
Guys.
And we'll come back.
For This Life or X Company. It's a comic book. Yeah.
I thought that was great.
Thanks.
I actually, I'm going to go out on a limb and say I like that better than the pilot. Not that there's anything wrong with the pilot, but
there's pilots are hard.
So much humor in that.
Yes. And that was a real thing about the pilot. And I see, like, and there's stuff in the pilot that happens that, like, never happens again. Like, she does all these, like, crazy kicks in the air on wires. And we're like, we just can't do that again. So, Yeah, there's stuff in that episode I love. Like, it's definitely not my favorite episode, and I think it just gets better and better, as everybody says. But there's moments where you're like, oh, this show is at least interesting and weird and crazy. And but, you know, my favorite thing is, like, we had so many problems. Like, the Shadow Assassin is walking so slowly. The girls could, like, go for ice cream, and, like, it's fine. They can just walk away from him, right? It's like, there's so I just wanted you to see that, like, that is a show with, like, not the hugest budget, to be completely honest. But at the end of the day, it's still about characters and kind of being brave and making bold choices. And like I said, the genre audience shows up knowing they're watching a comic book come to life. So
you took after The Walking Dead, right? It's always like, why?
Yeah.
You could just run away.
With several less zombies. Yeah, exactly. But yeah, thanks. Thank you. Yeah, the pilot was challenging. Pilots are always really hard, and tone is really hard in a pilot, right? Like, I see such a huge difference in Melanie's performance, who's Winona, from the pilot to the second episode. And then I still see such huge growth from this episode to, like, episode 13. So, right. Yeah.
Perfect time to maybe talk a bit about casting.
Yeah.
I think, you know, and this is maybe speaking from my personal experience, but I think casting is such a hard thing because you live with these characters in your head.
Yep.
You know, eventually you start to hear their voices if you live with them long enough. Mm-hmm. And then you have to go into a casting room.
Yeah.
And you're sort of, on one hand, looking for that person who fits your vision, but on the other hand, trying to put all those preconceived notions aside.
Totally.
Because someone might come in and do something completely different,
yeah.
Right, that you never expected, and being able to say, oh, wow, like, that's even better than what I thought. And I just think it's such magic. It's such an art. And, like, if anyone here wants to maybe, you know, start a casting for showrunners, I would take that course.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't learn, like, where do you learn that? There's no school to go for that. What?
There isn't. And, like, to be honest, I have, like, 8 other executive producers, all dudes who have very different idea of what they thought Winona was, right? I feel like we were particularly lucky with this cast. Like, they truly are magnificent and incredible. They all have incredible chemistry together.
But how did you know it was them? Like, well, you know, when they walked into the room?
Some of them, I won't say who, some of them I knew immediately. Some of them surprised me, and some of them I was like, well, it's always a leap of faith, right? Like, Dominique, who was Waverly, had never really done that much. Like, she's done some stuff, but she blew me away. You know, as time went on, I was like, oh, my God, she's such a fine. Melanie, I absolutely adored. She did the most insane audition where she, like, chewed gum the whole time. She was completely off her rocker. She had, like, blonde hair. It was such a brave, natural audition. But Winona is such a big character, right? You're like, that's going to be, everybody's going to have an opinion on who Winona is in their own minds. It's funny, when Doc Holliday, who's Tim, who kind of, I've worked with him before, so he almost had the opposite bias. I'd worked with him so much that I was like, I love Tim, but, like,
he's from Instant Star.
Yeah. I was like, I don't, or he's on Schitt's Creek and stuff. I was like, I just don't see him as Doc Holliday. And he was like, just let me read for it, because he's, like, the biggest comic book fiend in the world, and, like, I've never seen an audition like that. Like, I've seen him act in a million things. He completely transformed. He was absolutely incredible. And then Shamira as well was amazing. The biggest thing about casting, and I hear this a lot if you want to know a secret, is, like, I feel like I got my first choice for everybody on the show. What often happens is you have a big group of people and the network and producers is you often end up with, like, your third choice, because everybody has a different first choice. So to make everyone happy, you kind of go with everybody's second choice or everybody's third choice. So it's just a gut feeling. And, you know, when I started watching Winona's, like, we must have seen 300 actresses. Everybody's good until you watch them all together, and then your stupid words start to sound the same, and you just look for someone who stands out. But
so how did you get your first choice then? Like, bribes?
Bribes. Just, I think it's them. Like, to do them credit, I think Melanie's absolutely extraordinary. Like, and she was up against some big name actresses and stuff like that. But we just did callbacks, and it just became clear that, like, she could hold her own. And she could really do that sarcasm and still be likable, which I think was really critical for Winona. She's glib, and she's not perfect, and she's flawed. So you have to still like her, even when she's fucking up over and over and over and over again. So,
When we were talking on the phone for a little pre-interview that we did, you had a cold.
Yeah,
and you actually
still
said
do.
You, yeah. Yeah, you actually, thanks for being here.
No, I'm
you actually said to me, and I don't know if it's my husband's family is British and Scottish, so maybe it's because they've taught me to say bury. But you said there's this trope called bury your gaze.
Yeah.
And the way you said it, I thought you meant, like, bury your gaze, like, you know, Great Barrier Reef, right?
Oh,
and
that's,
like,
hilarious.
You're like, it's very controversial. And I'm thinking on the phone going, this is terrible. They're using gay people as human shields.
Yeah. Just like, they kind of are.
I hung up the phone and went, Oh, she's bury your gays.
Right, right. Oh, yeah, seriously.
Or dead lesbian syndrome or whatever you want to call it. So, I mean, your show, this show and Lost Girl have kind of become a little bit of a gold standard for LGBTQ representation on television in Canada. I mean, really, no one's doing it the way those shows do it.
Thanks.
Was that like was that a conscious choice that you said I see these stereotypes and I want to do something different, or was it just what was right for the characters? And then the nice byproduct of that was that you get good press and everyone's kind of glad to see something different.
Right, a little of both, to be honest. Lost Girl was such an eye-opening experience. Like I said, that had a protagonist who was bisexual, who ultimately ends up with her female love interest. And I was really proud of that. Like, that was a lead who ended up with a girl, which was amazing. And so because of that, we obviously attracted some very passionate LGBT fans. So I was very aware, because of what they would tell me, of kind of the dangers of dead lesbian syndrome and stuff like that. Now, 2016 turned out to be kind of a crazy year. I don't know how many of you know this, but, like, it was just, like, this... A lot of lesbians died on television this year. Like, a lot.
Apparently were used as human shields.
Oh, literally as human shields. I'm like, it could be bury your gays. But it was sort of just a horrible coincidence. The CW in particular got so much flack for, on the 100, basically what happened was the power couple there, Calexa. They basically, the trope is that when lesbians have sex or admit their sexuality, they often die. And it's kind of that old, an old standby take on, like, you should be punished for having sex, right? So basically, they killed off the lesbian character on the 100. She took a stray bullet that was intended for her lover. And over the course of, like, 3 weeks, CW killed off a ton of lesbians, a bunch of shows. The lesbian on Walking Dead took an arrow in the eye. And, like, you know, I think there's an argument that if you're on a show like Walking Dead, everyone is expendable. But it just became, for the LGBT community, that they don't have very much representation of themselves on television, and they're dying in disproportionate numbers. So so obviously we have an LGBT relationship on the show.
Between Waverly and Nicole
Hott, the subtlest name ever. thank you. And I knew very early on that, like, that was a relationship we would hopefully root for seasons. And we made a funny choice, which was in the finale, spoiler alert if you haven't seen it. I know you guys have all seen it 10 times, just kidding, no quiz. In the last, both Waverly and Nicole get shot in different episodes, but Nicole in particular gets shot in the finale, but she's wearing a bulletproof vest, which still worked for the character. She's a cop, right? And, like, the town's all gone crazy. She puts on a bulletproof vest and we do that reveal. So basically, the lesbian survives. And it's funny, when we first started the show, there was so much damage from what had happened with 2016 with the Bury Your Gays that people, honestly, a lot of LGBT fans were like, I'm scared to start your show because I think people are going to die. So we did something kind of unprecedented near the end of the show, which we said, they don't die, which is like an absolute no-no. And I'm sure a lot of people here will have questions about that or would have done it differently. But I felt it was kind of interesting to do that to the community who had been burned and say, I'm not saying they're not going to be in danger. I'm not going to say they're not going to be in peril. But I give you this, is that at least this season, they both survive to the end. So we did get a lot of press for that. And we also just got a lot of press for having so many female characters, to be honest, like so many three-dimensional female characters. So I feel lucky I knew that trope. I learned about that trope because of Lost Girl, because I was on a show that was really diverse and the community really adopted it as its own. And I feel like, if nothing else, kind of, the fact that that has happened this year is educating other showrunners and other writers that maybe this is a situation we need to rectify and be aware of. But that community has been incredibly supportive of the show. So that's good.
Maybe talk a little bit about your show and how you like to kind of staff your room and structure it. I mean, I think I just had a conversation recently with another writer who was saying that she really hates structure. Like, she's like, I'm really character development. And I said, well, we should work together.
I love structure.
Right. Structure is my thing. Like, I love breaking story. Right. And I hate character development. Like, there's some writers who are like, you know, when this character was 9, she burned her hand and that, you know, spun into this thing that she had for the whole. I can't. I hate that.
You're like, get to the story.
Right. Exactly. So how, like, when you're staffing your room, what do you look for in writers? Do you look for that? Like, oh, this person's really good at structure? Or
it's honestly, I wish I could be less shallow, but it's honestly a personality
match. To have six packs?
Yeah, they have to have six packs. No, but like, the thing about television that no one ever tells you is, like, it is collaborative. It's more like working on a newspaper, right? It's not writing a novel. It's not writing a film by yourself in front of your computer. I have to sit with you for 10 hours a day. My blood sugar is going to be low. I'm not always going to be at my best. I have to enjoy being around you. And that sounds incredibly glib, but that is the truth. It's incredibly collaborative, a television writing room. So I really look for writers I like. But more than that, I put a lot of stock in enthusiasm. Like, I want people who like the show, which sounds so simple, but sometimes people just need a job and they don't care about the show. I need you to respect the audience. And, like, you have to buy into the crazy crap we're doing here or the audience won't, right? So I look for writers who are enthusiastic, who never give up. I run a pretty democratic room. I like a lot of voices. Like, I'm not very hierarchical. Did I just say that right? Just hierarchical?
Yes, you did.
And, like, look, I look for good writers, but the other truth is I feel like I have an incredible team of writers. I should say that on the show. They're all amazing, but they don't all have the same skill sets. Like, I have some writers who are better at breaking and some people who are not so good at breaking. I have some people who are better on the page and some people who maybe take more drafts than others. And I think it's okay to recognize people's strengths and weaknesses. But I really just want people who don't give up, who want the job, who work hard, and who maybe laugh at my stupid jokes and vice versa. You know, it really is a team. It really is a family. For the first season of Wynonna, we all picked up and moved to Calgary. So, like, it was important that we liked each other. It's amazing, too, like any group dynamic, one person, no matter what their level, can really change the tone of the room. If there's someone in there who's really thin-skinned or can't take notes or can't take criticism or is overly critical of others or competitive or petty, it can change the entire tone of the room. The writing room, 99% of things I pitch is absolute garbage, right? Like, you're trying everything. Like, anything goes. It has to be a safe space. So that's really critical, I think. More than anything, there has to be trust. So
I always joke there's no stupid people. Stupid ideas, just stupid people.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, put that on the maybe pile. And, like, so many times I feel less even egotistical about this the older I get as well. It's like, so many times I'll, like, do the complete opposite of what I said we should do. I'm like, if this isn't working, why don't we completely flip the idea, you know? And so if a story is stalled, so often that works. That you're like, let's do the complete opposite of what we were trying to do or the thing I just said we couldn't do. So I just like people who work hard. The business is grueling. We talked about this earlier. Like, you might work for 6 months, 20 hours a day, and then be off for 4 months. But I really need people who will be puppy dogs about it a little bit. Like, you have to start at 100% because the show's going to beat you down and you're going to get to 12%. If you come in at 60%, you're already dead. So
it's amazing that, like,
really, though, that's kind of true.
Like, it's a good reminder, you know, be a nice person, be enthusiastic, you know, love what you do, right?
Exactly. Like,
it seems so simple, but it's amazing that that's kind of challenging to find sometimes.
Yeah, you know? I think so. As far as, like, structure or character, I don't really have any hard and fast rules. Like, I kind of just go with my gut. I do think that particularly on a show like this, which with such a low budget, it all comes back to character. Like, I really think you have to know how this character would act in this scene or else it's just going to read false. So that's just my one sticking point is, like, don't make this character do that because it moves the plot along, because Wynonna would never, ever do that or whatnot. So I guess that's kind of my thing. Yeah.
Okay, cool. I think, you know, the one challenge with this country that, you know, they maybe don't get so much stateside is, I once heard Vince Gilligan speak, and he was saying that
Who?
He...
Just kidding.
Yeah, exactly. Little Vince Gilligan. Little show called Breaking Bad, you might know
exactly.
It.
Yeah, exactly.
And I said, you know, he was asked how he started in the business, and he, you know, got on the X-Files and worked his way up the rungs.
Whoa.
And then, and then, you know, Chris Carter was ready to move on, and he got a chance to showrun and, like, learn. I don't even know if he actually showrun, but anyway, he got mentored by Chris Carter for all those years.
Right.
And then the network loved him and said, you know, let's do a show. And anyway, it was a much more complicated story than that. I'm simplifying. But in Canada, I mean, you're lucky if your show goes 3 seasons.
Oh, yeah.
4 is amazing.
Ten
seasons just doesn't happen. So there's a lot less potential to train. You know, you can't come in as, like, a junior story editor and then work your way up every year. And then hopefully by season 8, the showrunners moved on to their next project.
Right.
And, you know, you're their right hand and you can be
take
a showrunner
over.
And take over. There's not that training. So, and I think you maybe touched on this a little bit earlier, but who was kind of critical to, like, who was your mentor? Who, like, actually kind of took you under your wing and taught you this? Or is it something that you kind of had to learn on the fly, the job of showrunning?
the job of showrunning, nothing prepares you for. Like, I think, again, it's such a different hat to go from writing to showrunning. I've had so many good writer mentors, and they've all taught me different things. Like, my first room on Instant Star was kind of funny. There were only three of us. There was Michelle Lavretta and James Hurst. And James is really a structure guy, and Michelle is like, I just want it to be awesome. She's like, I just want an explosion in Act 3. I don't know anything else. I don't care. I just know I have that in my head. So I kind of felt like I had the best training because he was really structure, and she was really like, kaboom. So I think those two really helped me. Michelle in particular has been a mentor to me, as I've said. She's incredible. The first time I met her, she was wearing like a Gucci skirt and like 8-inch heels, and I was wearing like overalls, and we're like, we're best friends now, right? Like, she just doesn't take any guff. She really goes with her guts. And like, one thing she taught me that I don't always feel is so Canadian is like, when in doubt, just make it awesome. Like, why can't it just be awesome? Let's try to just make it awesome and then later let them tell us we can't make it awesome, which sounds really glib, but this is the truth, right? We have smaller budgets, and especially on something like this, like, it should just be crazy. It should just be fun. Like, I think that's undervalued in television, that people work all day and they just come home and maybe want to watch something insane and not depressing, right?
And sometimes we overthink it, you think, a little bit?
I think a little bit, yeah. I've worked with so many amazing writers, and like, without naming names, I've also worked with people who I thought were absolutely horrible showrunners. Do you know what I mean? Or producers who I thought were god awful. I feel like I've worked with showrunners who treated their staffs like garbage, who didn't utilize their staffs to their full potential. I learned from that too. You know, I thought if I'm ever lucky enough to have my own show, the one thing you have control over is how you act, how you treat other people, not to Dr. Phil it, but like, that's true, right? Like, you can't control how other people are going to be, but you truly have a choice every day about how you're going to treat people who are just there to do their best. So even the ones I won't name who I was like, this person is a garbage person. That taught me something too, you know?
You're giving me awesome segues to my questions. Okay, Thank you so much.
Because who's a garbage person is your next question? Okay, here's a list.
Garbage person.
Career over.
Because one of the things I thought was kind of charming when we had our pre-interview was like, you're like, I'm happy to talk about my failures. And like, so many people aren't willing to talk about their failures, you know? Yeah. I mean, especially in an industry that's so ego-driven, it's like, oh, if I don't fail, like, I'm perfect all the time.
Right.
And I think you're absolutely right. I think you learn the most in failure.
Yeah.
And you never know what you need to know until you know it, right?
Right.
And so, you know... How to phrase this? Is there like a specific moment
How does
that
it feel to be a failure?
No. hardly think that's applicable here. Is there something that you wish you knew then, like when you first started showrunning, or when you first started writing, or you're first in rooms, that you know now? Because I mean, it is a constant evolution, right?
Right.
I mean, you're always learning and hopefully getting better.
Right. This is a great question. Less so about showrunning, because I kind of said the lesson I learned with showrunning is that, like, you're just not going to get it all done and someone's going to go home disappointed and in a huff with you. But you're like, dude, my day was insane. I think the most scared I've ever been was when I actually got my first job on Instant Star and was a junior. Because there's something so glorious when you write your first spec script. And I look to all you young writers, hopefully, in the audience. You don't know what you don't know, and there's something charming about that on the page, right? There's something brave, and you just try your best, and you have a voice. And then I got in a room, and I was like, I don't know any of these writing terms. I don't know what anyone is talking about. Writers really have, like, a fast language. I was so terrified. I had, like, days where I was driving to work. Like, what would happen if I just crashed my car just enough so my hands got broken? Like, that kind of stuff, right? Super normal. And, like, you need that fear, though, too, right? The fear of wanting to do well for a showrunner I love. But also, the deeper down the pit I went, the more I realized I knew nothing. I couldn't critically read someone else's script, I felt, and give notes when I barely knew how to do the job myself. And now that I'm a showrunner at the ripe old age of 22, what I would say to myself is, like, I was the junior. Nobody expected me to fix everything. Do you know what I mean? Like, just the fact that I showed up every day in my overalls and kind of pitched stupid ideas and tried to support my team was enough. Like, I was trying my best. I knew what I didn't know. And I always remember the first time, and it sounds so simplistic, there's a real difference between writing and editing. The first time I read a script and it was like Beautiful Mind, I could see the whole thing and I was like, what if we took out this scene and act one is starting too slowly? That was like the biggest epiphany I've personally ever had in writing. When I came back for my second year of Instant Star, I was like, I can see the whole thing now, someone else's script. So what I would just say is, like, it's important to be scared at the beginning. It's really, really important. And it's important to still be scared when you're the boss. You can use that fear and like use it. Do you know what I mean? Use it and like challenge yourself and make it better. If you ever get complacent, it's over. It's funny, like when I became a showrunner, I became a showrunner because someone else got fired. And it was like being given the wheel of the Titanic, right? But in a weird way, there was nowhere left to hide. I was like, we are either going down or we're just going to steer this into shore. But in a weird way, there was no one else to let down. I was just going to have to go with my guts. And that was interesting, too. You know, I was kind of like, everyone knows it's me. It's either going to work or it's not. So I'm just going to make the decisions.
Well, that's actually a truth, I think, about Canadian television is that's often how you get your job.
Yeah, sometimes.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, like we're saying, there's not the training ground. So there's not the like lovely transition period into like sort of partially show running and then learning your trade and then and then actually doing it. Like oftentimes it is that like, wow, okay, so do you want the job?
Right. Yeah. And like, you're like, am I arrogant enough to think I can do this where others have failed? But like, again, all you can do is try your best, which sounds like when I got my job, the network said to me, okay, well, I guess the understudy is taking over. And I was like, oof. But like, you're also like, I'm going to use that, right? Like, damn right I am. We got 200 people on set waiting for me to make a decision. So here's what we're doing, right? And there's freedom in that. There's no doubt about it. Like, there's, like I said, there's nowhere left to hide. So,
and I think a truth about our industry is that it's not necessarily a lack of talent. Everyone has gotten to that level of talented. Yeah. It's often just personality differences.
Oh, some of the best writers I know have been fired too. Like, and I've been fired. Like, actually, the first time I was fired, I was surprised. The thing I felt the most was relief because I was like, the show is a nightmare. This is not working. And I'm not going to die. You know, I am going to go home and cry. But like, it's fine. You know, it is. It's just like anything. It's a personality matter. It doesn't fit. You don't get the show. You know, I remember the first time I worked on a show and I couldn't get it. And I realized this sounds super arrogant, but I was like, maybe the problem isn't me this time. Maybe the problem is you can't tell me what you want the show to be. Right. And like, that's OK. That's OK. But the thing about this country, I think, is really hard is I wish we had more television because I think it's easy. And I believe that Dennis McGrath talks about this a lot. It's easy to get your first job. It's those mid-level jobs that are hard to get, right? It's hard to like keep going and keep training and be kind of a third and stuff like that. So, yeah, I wish we just, again, I wish we fostered this industry a little bit more so we could, we have so many talented people here, but
it's true. A lot of people get stuck in that mid-level,
yeah,
you know, and they just can't, they can't make it to the show running position because
there's just not enough.
Like you said, they're not there at the time when someone gets fired. So they're not in the right place at the right time. And getting your own show is so difficult
in
this country.
I feel so privileged. I can't believe we got this thing made. Did you just see this thing? It's insane. But yeah, it's a total privilege. And like I said, you always got to be scared. It's in a good way, right? Like you always got to challenge yourself.
I don't think the fear ever goes away. That's
no,
a, that's
it shouldn't.
That's a secret.
And I don't trust any writer who's like, I got this. I'm like, oh, do you? Yeah. Let's see. Like, it's good. It's good to want it to be so good, you know? So
and it's also kind of charming in a lovely way that when you meet people who have been doing this for a lot of years and they still are like, I don't know, is this good? You know, and it's a more collaborative. It's a lovely kind of thing to hold on to. On that note, can we do a few question and answers with the audience? If you have a question, just I think there's mics on both sides. So maybe raise your hand and they'll pass you a mic.
Anybody?
Yes.
I'm not familiar with the comic book, but I'm a big fan of like, you know, like Daredevil and Jessica Jones and how do you adopt that from the comic book. So I was just wondering, for people who don't know the comic book, could you talk about like what difficulties there were in like transferring it to a TV format?
Sure.
Like,
So the truth about this comic book, as I've said, is like as much as Wynonna is a very fully formed character, there's way less in common with the comic book on the series than there would be with a Jessica Jones, for example. You know what I mean? She just runs around the country fighting supernatural demons. Like I said, she's kind of, it's a lot of TNA. So I really want to take it back to her origin stories just because of the fact that, like, I can't afford to have her on a plane flying across the country fighting gremlins and whatnot. It's really, really nerve-wracking and tense when you are working with someone else's IP, right? Like I was working with the author, Bo Smith, who wrote the original comic book, and you never know what you're going to get, right? You never know if they're going to be furious at you that you're taking what they have essentially created and making it a completely different show for a completely different medium. I was incredibly blessed that I worked with this guy, Bo Smith, who understood inherently that like it just wasn't going to be the same. You know, he was like, I'm awesome at writing comic books. I don't know how to write TV. I want to reach a wider audience. So he trusted me, which was really great. And he in turn has turned around and is now writing comic books based on the TV series. So my experience was pretty positive. And it's a cult comic book. Like, I would be interested if it was something like from Marvel, which has a huge fan base. I think that would be more challenging in such that the fans have certain expectations. I feel like this was different enough that you could enjoy both separately, if that makes sense. So, thanks.
Anybody else?
Yes.
That was awkward.
I liked it. It's okay.
Thanks. I think there's something really joyful about genre that is particularly attached to the sense of humor. Mm. Like, so something that always that I love about genre TV in particular is how goddamn funny it is. Mm. But it's funny in a way that seems closer to realism in comedy, if that mm-hmm. makes any sense. It seems like this sort of really lovely, like, everything is so fucked up, so yeah. Let's just be smart asses about it, because mm-hmm. there's like demons and shit. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about maybe the particular sort of constraint or texture of writing genre that is also really, really funny.
Sure, I'd love to talk about that. I'm obviously kind of a smart ass. And I really wanted it to be funny. Like, I really put stock in huge switches in tone. I would love to have you cry and laugh in the exact same episode. You know what I mean? I think genre is a big, crazy world. It's fun to do big, crazy storytelling. It was a fight on this. Like, a lot of genre is very, very serious, you know? Jessica Jones is incredible. It's sort of funny, but, like, it's Daredevil in particular. It's, like, it's pretty dark, right? I just think what is happening is so ridiculous on screen that it is fun to react to it in a way that maybe real people would, you know? But like I said, I really pitched this show to Sci-Fi as something that was more Guardians of Galaxy than, say, Superman versus Batman. I wanted it to be fun. I just think it's such a ridiculous concept, right? Like, who's kidding who? She's like the descendant of Wyatt Earp. She has a magic gun. She's like running around fighting these demons that are trapped in her hometown, and like everyone in her hometown hates her. I think that's funny. And again, I feel like genre audiences are smart enough to understand that this is a ridiculous concept, so you can have fun with that. I'm going to be honest, it was actually a real fight, right? Like, humor is so subjective. And you really see it in kind of the difference between the pilot and the second episode, for example. Like, people have different opinions of what is funny. So I feel quite happy that people like Wynonna's humor and like the humor in the show. But like I said, just the truth about genre is, because you're dealing with crazy situations, it does kind of reflect back on the human condition, right? So it's a chance to laugh and cry and all that stuff. But
there's been a lot of comparisons to Buffy, right? Which is,
I know, which is huge. Amazing. I know, it's like the hugest compliment ever. And like, I'm not going to pretend I'm not like, oh, let's just rip off Buffy. Just getting Joss Whedon.
No, pay homage.
Pay homage to Buffy. And Buffy changed the world, right? As far as genre, I think it really changed the way we think about genre and character and whatnot. And that was really a great example of character before budget. It didn't matter, right? So I'm happy with those comparisons, even if it's like 10% is good. I'm like, awesome, good, no problem.
Yeah. Any other questions?
Yes. Who's there? Oh, the microphone people are in charge.
Hi.
Hi.
You've talked a little bit about the limitations of the budget and the effect that has on the special effects. Mm-hmm. How does that affect the writing process? Like, where do you decide we're going to spend, you know, the money on this action scene rather than some other thing?
It's something I want to say. I want to say, go Canada. Like, it's another thing that Canadian writers have to learn that's incredibly challenging. Like, today I was in my writing room and we had a scene where like a bunch of mercenaries were going to attack one of our characters. And he was saying that this had happened, right? And my junior just said to me, I just want to see that. And I was like, I know, but we can't afford that. You know, we can afford this other thing we're talking about or that. So I often say, I think working in Canada with budget restraints has made me a more creative writer, because I have to think about the best way to tell the story on the budget with the least amount of characters. You know, I wouldn't know what to do with Game of Thrones money, but I'm willing to try.
I think you'd know
so,
what
like,
to do
honestly,
with it.
Honestly, it almost does make you a better storyteller, right? You have to think of the best way to tell the story you want to tell within those constraints. You know, it still breaks your heart a little bit. It never quite looks as it looks in your mind. But that's why I think, when in doubt, the thing that has made this show such a fan hit is the relationships. It is the sisters talking to each other in front of the fire. You know what I mean? It still comes down to character. And we've all seen movies that rely on special effects that just make you feel nothing, right? So I still think if you're a good writer, even if you don't like genre, if you like writing character and good dialogue, it's okay, you know? But it is an extra thing Canadian writers have to worry about. You really have to do it in a way that is budget conscious, not just the best story. So I feel like it's a hard thing to learn. It's a hard thing to learn. Yep. It's another puzzle piece.
There's a couple, there's two other hands up, I think. Maybe we'll do those two. And
yeah. It's okay. Sure.
Hi.
Can you speak a little bit to the creation of Beau and the creation of Winona and not letting these three-dimensional women get noted into cardboard cutout status?
Sure. I feel really lucky. Like, I have to say to writing in Canada, I don't know if these shows could get made anywhere but Canada, right? I just don't know if they could, to be completely honest. Beau is not my creation. Beau is Lavretta's creation, Michelle Lavretta's creation. And it's amazing that show got made. I got tons of notes on both those shows that were like, she wouldn't do this because she's a woman. The best note I ever got was like, she wouldn't eat ice cream after a breakup because she's so beautiful. And I was like, she doesn't care. She just got her heart broken. So, like, lots of notes like that. Like, I just think you got to pick your battles, right? And that was one battle that was really particular for me. I was like, it was really important to me that the female leads were three-dimensional. So those were battles I always picked, for lack of a better term. Like, with good results, you know? I was always willing to let everything else go, except I wanted them to feel like real people. I mean, real crazy people in the real world. But it was a struggle. But
isn't that hilarious that making them real people is a struggle?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's changing for sure again. One thing I think that helped again on both those shows is they had multiple female characters. So no female character had to be representative of all women. Do you know what I mean? Which is sometimes hard. If you have one female character, they have to be everything to everybody. Whereas I feel like on both Lost Girl and Winona, you know, we have Waverly, who's perky. We had Kenzie, who was kind of a badass. We had Beau, who was like the sexiest puppy ever. We have Winona, who's kind of a dumbass, but also sarcastic and vulnerable. We have Nicole Hott, who's like principled and knows what she wants, but is a good person. So I think I kind of loaded both shows with a lot of female characters and then just let them run. But again, like, I for the most part, I felt lucky in Canada. I didn't get a ton of blowback, and I just would fight those notes in particular. I would be like, I think they would do this, but yeah, you do get crazy notes still.
I think there was somebody around here who had a question.
I wanted to ask you about your process in particular in the writer's room. I know you're writing season two right now.
Yes, starting, hopefully.
How's that going?
Fine. Do you have an outline? Just give me whatever you got. Yeah, no.
Okay, don't tempt me.
Yes, I do.
Yeah, exactly. Good. It's going fine. This is the fun part, right? Because at the beginning, like, anything could happen. So you're like, yay, no one said no yet. So, yeah.
That must be fun.
Yeah, it is fun. Yeah.
So where do you actually start? Do you map the plot first, or do you have character stuff that you want to bring out? Like, what's your kind of egg that you try to hatch right away?
That's a great question. So, with genre, obviously, there's a ton of mythology. Like, I pity the person in the audience who watched that without seeing the pilot and being like, what is happening? Who are these people, right? So on genre, there's a ton of mythology, and you have to plot it out. So I start macro and go micro. I mean, because both this show, obviously, is called Winona Earp. It's titled after the lead character. I want to know what journey Winona goes on every season, right? In the same way you would with Buffy. Like, what is her journey this year? But also, who's the big bad? What is she fighting? What do we want to happen? So I tend to start with mythology first, like, you know, big ideas, then character by character, what journey they're going to go on, and then episode by episode, so to speak. Because you really have to lay out all that mythology early or you'll get totally screwed. You'll have the episode where everyone's just like listing what happened. Like, it's got to be this. We got to get this MacGuffin and we got to get the sword of whatever. And oh my God, we got to get this. Like, you really have to seem smarter than that to the audience, hopefully. So you have to plot all that stuff out first. I think season two is probably going to be more serialized than season one, too, which is great. I think genre audiences like that. But different showrunners are different. Different showrunners love theme or character first or backstory, what have you. I want to make sure every one of my characters has something shocking and crazy that happens to them this season. So, but it's got to be genuine based on who the character is.
It's almost nine. What do you think? Maybe one more question? Uh-oh, how do we pick?
I'm going to answer them super fast, so you can do three. Just yell it out. Oh, God.
So the first episode and the second episode, a lot of rockiness, right?
Right.
And now since, congratulations on the second season.
Thank you.
Now it's more smoother, right?
Hopefully.
Okay, right.
If you say it out loud, it makes it true. So hopefully. Right. Yeah.
What would you say, what's the biggest learning curve for you? What made it really nice and smooth from Rocky?
Right. A couple of things. First of all, the problem with first season is like you have to explain the concept, you have to explain the mythology, and you have to introduce the characters. Now you hopefully love the characters. You don't care. You're like, I love those two together. Send them to Fight Club, whatever, right? Like, people already know who these characters are. Also, knowing what my cast can do is huge. You know what I mean? Like, now I feel like I know who's capable of telling a joke, who can cry on cue, who's good with who, what kind of humor works in our show, who can't deliver a joke. So tone, too, I think is huge. You see this really in comedy. If you watch any first season of comedy, like, it's so wildly different from the pilot to episode 5 to episode 7. Tone is huge. Tone, what the cast can do. And just the benefit of not having to put out all the gobbledygook, like all the rules of the world, right? In a way that's not, again, someone just listing it. So hopefully.
Definitely.
Hopefully. Yeah. Who wants to go fast? Yell it out and I'll answer if you super, super fast.
Sorry. Okay.
No problem.
I want to write for TV one day. And
good.
Yeah.
Yes.
as far as I know, story coordination is the in job. And I was wondering if you had any advice on how to find ways to get a story coordinator job.
It's tough. I'm not going to lie to you. Like, most story coordinators want to be writers, but the truth is I need a story coordinator, right? I know you want to be a writer. I need someone who's going to coordinate, who's going to do script work, who's very good with detail, stuff like that. Honestly, it's the same way to be a writer, to be honest. I think you need an agent, to be honest. Like, I would generally look for junior writers at agencies, interview them, see if I think they can coordinate. So that's my advice. I think you've got to get your scripts into the hand of an agent or another mentor who can get you to an agent. You really need one person to go to bat for you, okay? You need a producer, you need a director, you need an agent, or you need a senior writer, and then hopefully they can show for you a little bit. So,
or even, I would just throw in the Canadian Film Center has its primetime program. I know I came from there.
Anyone here from the Canadian Film Center right now?
There's a lot of writers who came through that program, primetime television resident program. There's like the National Screen Institute has Totally Television. That tends to be a little bit more, Totally Television, yeah. I mean, tends to be a little bit more, you have a couple credits under your belt when you get that. But I mean, there are programs like that that are amazing because they open so many doors. Like, you meet everybody in the industry. So, you know, that if you can get in to a program like that,
definitely.
You have great specs. That is also a really good way to meet people.
Mm-hmm. Shirley, go ahead.
Hi,
how are you?
Good. I have a question regarding Nicole Hott's Tumblr/diary.
Right.
Like, how you came up with that concept, and like, no other like TV show or anything like gives fans that like in-depth insight on the character.
So I'll answer this for the people who don't know. Like, this show really was built. We didn't have a lot of money. We didn't have a lot of marketing. We are on like Friday at 10 p.m. after wrestling on Sci-Fi. Woo! This show was really built on the back of social media. That's true. Wynonna really kind of took off on Twitter, took off on Tumblr, took off on Instagram, whatever. We really kind of fostered the fandom. All the actors did live tweeting. We did it every Friday night. It really became this party atmosphere. Lots of showrunners hate that stuff. I think it's really important with genre. I think you're creating a community. You want people to feel part of it. So as one of the gifts to the fan, what we did when the show was over was we wrote a journal for Nicole Hott, who's the cop, and the fandom had to guess the password, which was the license plate on her car, to enter the Tumblr. We just did it because the more viral stuff like that we do, the more we feel it spreads by word of mouth. You know, I just think there are 500 shows on television right now, Peak TV, whatever. Anything you can do to have an edge to reach an audience is really important, especially with genre, especially with something with LGBT content, especially for a female audience. They really know how to use social media. So that was kind of a thank you to the fans, to be honest, just for doing that. And the more stuff you can do to keep people interested between seasons, the better. So,
do you have somebody who coordinates that? Because, I mean, that is yet like another thing on your to-do list.
It's hard. Like, I have to be honest. Like, yeah, every Friday night I would live tweet. We have Digital Howard who does, like, our website and stuff like that. But, no, like, we're a pretty scrappy, young Canadian production. So it's just, it is another thing on our to-do list, to be honest. But to be honest, we had the luxury, at least, that we were done filming by the time we really kind of picked up the social media. So that was a little easier, yeah.
You weren't gainfully employed at that moment.
No, like, I couldn't do it now. I'd be like, I can't do it. Yeah.
Okay, anything else?
Thank you so much, Nicole. Thank you so much, Nicole Demers, everywhere.
Thank you for coming out and you know, talking
about
the show.
Thank you for coming in the rain. Thank you so much, you guys. Yeah.
And good luck on season two.
Thank you. Yes. If anyone has any ideas, just tell me. Just kidding. Don't tell me. Yeah, exactly. What do you guys think should happen?
Writers Talking TV podcasts are presented by the Writers Guild of Canada. All of the Writers Talking TV podcasts can be found on the Writers Guild website, wgc.ca, and at iTunes. If you enjoyed the podcast tonight, please share your feedback at iTunes or email writerstalkingtv@gmail.com. That's writerstalkingtv, all one word, @gmail.com. Special thanks to the team at TIFF Bell Lightbox. The podcast's technical producer is Philip Vukovic. I'm Nicole Demers. Thanks so much for listening.